So last week we talked about things changing and the fact that the only thing that doesn't change is the fact that everything changes. So impermanence. And I talked about flow as being a term that I use to describe a direct experience of impermanence or of change in action. So we can experience things that we're observing changing, and if we choose to pay attention to the change as opposed to the thing itself, we are observing what I would call flow. Now, flow actually has a very rich and deep significance, but it's hard to put into words and hard to really be aware of sometimes, even though. All since there was words to write with, people have tried to describe this experience of change. I mentioned last week that the experience of qi when you're getting acupuncture is pretty much flow. I would say the same as flow, but technical definitions may vary, but the experience is essentially the same thing. And that's a Taoist idea, the qi, and it has gotten into Chinese medicine. Its flow is like kundalini energy, which is Hindu practice, and kundalini yoga, which perhaps some of you have practiced, is intended to get that kundalini energy moving through your body. And the experience of that energy is the same experience as what I'm calling flow. And in fact, I had a conversation just this week on Monday or Tuesday with a Kundalini yoga instructor who told me that often the experience of Kundalini energy is, you can hear it in your ears, is that sort of ringing in your ears that in the West we like to call tinnitus or tinnitus. So, from the Hindu yoga perspective, tinnitus is actually the energy, life force of energy. And in fact, I also use that noise in my ears as an object of meditation from time to time. So, tonight I want to go a little deeper into flow and what is so significant about it. When impermanence is spoken of in the context of meditation. The English word is often a translation of a Pali word. Pali is similar to Sanskrit. That's the language that the Buddha spoke and that the early Buddhist writings are in. The word anicca. Nicca means permanent, and the A makes it negative, so anicca is not permanent. Originally, in early Buddhism, this was very closely connected with the concept of suffering, because if you put your hopes for happiness or fulfillment in things or circumstances, because everything changes, eventually those things or circumstances, the things won't be there anymore, or they'll break, or the circumstances will change. So we set ourselves up for suffering because we don't understand impermanence. So that was an original connection. And another association was with the concept of no self or not self, which you might have heard of if you've done any Buddhist reading, which is about this thing that we considered to be us or me is not actually a thing. There's nothing I can point to that is solid and fixed and unchanging that is me. I'm actually just this sort of motion of manifesting all the time. And so there's no self, or what I think of me is not self, it's not a thing. So that is also connected with the idea of impermanence. And then, as time went on in Buddhism, it also, anicca became associated with a unification or merging or that becoming one that you hear about in Zen. You know, I'm one with the flower, I'm one with what is. That also is connected in with impermanence. So that's the Buddhist side of it. This experience of anicca is not limited to Buddhism. Those words are, the terminology may be, but we find it elsewhere. So if you look at the Christian mystic writings, you find these descriptions that sound really an awful lot like flow, right? Like the what I'm calling the direct experience of impermanence. And if you just look at the New Testament, right, you have Jesus talking about the Spirit is like rivers of living water flowing through you, which could be a description of the sensation of flow in your body. John the Baptist talked about being baptized by the Spirit and by fire, which has been interpreted as a purifying or a motivating activity, which again is a consequence of experiencing flow directly. The Transfiguration is described as a bright shining light, which sometimes is in experience in sight space. You can see light as or flow as light. So, and all through the New Testament and the Old Testament, you find these descriptions that sound like flow and have become called the Holy Spirit. And if this is maybe feels to you like I'm stretching it a little bit, trying to create this connection, read some of the mystics. Read St. Teresa of Avila or St. John of the Cross. There are some really, or even C.S. Lewis, there's some really clear descriptions that sound just like the experience of flow, just that in that context, it was associated with the God of Christianity. One example that I came across recently was a letter that he wrote, so it was in his collection of letters, to someone who had an experience, written to C.S. Lewis saying, I think I've had an experience of the Holy Spirit and it was like this and that. And he wrote back and said, yes, blah, blah, blah. And it could have as easily been my teacher, Shinzen, talking to me about flow. So, of course, I can't resist doing a little etymology. I love playing with words. So I looked at the Holy Spirit. I mean, I do look at the Holy Spirit from time to time when I'm meditating, but I looked at the words Holy Spirit, and they are a direct translation of the Latin Spiritus Sanctus, which the Catholic scriptures were written in. Spiritus Sanctus is a direct translation from Greek, Hagia Pneuma, and that's P-N-E-U-M-A, as in pneumatic, as in air, something to do with air. Now, I'm presuming that that phrase came into being shortly after the death of Jesus, when some of the scriptures were being written in Greek. And so Hagia Pneuma is a direct translation from Hebrew of the term Ruach HaKodesh. And forgive me for making a mess of these pronunciations. But it makes sense that the concept of Ruach HaKodesh was present in the time of Jesus. It's that word in the Jewish tradition describes that aspect of God which can inhabit and inspire a person. So that sort of goes along with what the Holy Spirit would be. So you can see that Jesus or the writers of the New Testament scriptures would borrow that phrase. But what I love is if you look at what that original phrase meant, Ruach HaKodesh, which happens all through the Old Testament also, in terms of God inhabiting and inspiring. And I'll say, before I translate that, that in the book of Acts, Luke wrote about Pentecost, which is when the Holy Spirit came upon the disciples. He described it as a roaring wind that was heard throughout the city. So ruach in Hebrew means wind or breath. So in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, Judaism and Christianity, God is experienced directly as this unseen power that is in constant motion, and that whatever it touches, it sort of sets to life or makes dance. You can imagine wind doing that. And this is the words that these two religious traditions chose to describe what they said was God inhabiting them. And oddly enough, I've talked about flow as being the motion that from which reality springs. So there's clearly a similarity there. And of course, in Islam, you would expect something similar, because that's also an Abrahamic faith. From the Quran, the word ruh, R-U-H, which is from the same root as the Hebrew ruach. In Arabic, it's ruh, means spirit of God. But I'm going to quote from a scholarly website about this. It's ruh is translated into English as spirit of God, but the deeper meaning of ruh is the closeness or connection with God. We also learn from the Quran that each and every human is created from God's ruh, or wind, or breath. And although the word can be safely understood as spirit, having the ruh of God inside us signifies that we have connection with God. So we're talking about an experience which connects us with our source. Whether or not you want to call it flow, or God, or spirit, or wind, or breath, or chi, or kundalini, it's something, a power in motion that connects us with the source of all things. So that's sort of significant. That's a good reason to look into impermanence and flow. And clearly this experience profoundly affects people. It transforms people. All through history, people have been writing about it and how life-changing it is. So let's look a little bit at why it's so powerful. Last week, I spoke a little bit about this experience of flow, and now I'm moving out of religion now. I'm just talking about looking at our sensory experience and noticing change happening in real time. So last week I spoke about that as being a purifier, in that when it's bubbling and fizzy, it's sort of knocking loose things that are stuck deep inside and bubbling them up to the surface so that they can be released. Or if it's undulating, massaging you, it can massage the knots out of your soul, as it were. And you can learn to taste that purification. Even when you're looking at very simple things like we've been talking about, like that itch on your arm that is getting more and more intense, if you're able to watch the change in that, you can begin to taste something happening. And of course, the deeper you look, the more stuff gets knocked about and the more purification happens. Another thing that is significant about impermanence and flow is that it's a unifier or an integrator. And I mentioned earlier on that in Buddhism it came to be associated with this. But you don't have to be mystical or religious to understand how this can be. So in February and March, well, mostly February, we talked a lot about noting practice and techniques that we use to observe that are distinguishing, that we learn to distinguish between different locations of sensations or different types of sensations. If you remember the see, hear, feel, distinction, is this a visual experience or a sensory experience? And we spend a lot of time talking about that and practicing. And distinctions are really important. For one thing, if you can distinguish between what is the experience of the moment and what is my internal reaction and what are my thoughts about it and what are my stories versus what am I actually hearing and seeing, then we're learning to see things as they really are, as opposed to what our brain is trying to tell us about it, and so we're more able to react appropriately. We can, by distinguishing, untangle unpleasant experiences so that we're no longer driven by the reaction or by the confusion that that tangle causes. We can untangle pleasant experiences and experience more fulfillment from them. So the distinguishing, the skill of distinguishing, is really important. But if you keep distinguishing deeply enough, in more and more detail, eventually you find, as I mentioned last week, that you start to see everything is made out of the same sort of elemental building blocks. So in the same way that the trees and the rocks and the animals are all made out of cells, which are made out of molecules, which are made out of the same atoms, we find that we are also made out of the same motions, the same little individual vibrations, the same flow as everything and everyone around us. So distinguishing in more and more detail eventually unifies and integrates everything. Let me give you an example so that maybe it'll be a little more clear. If you're looking, you're on a hillside and you're looking down and there's a wood over here and then there's a prairie with tall grass on it and it's a windy day, you can look over here and you can see that trees are blowing in the wind, and you can look over here and see that the grass is blowing in the wind, and that's distinguishing. You've got trees and you've got grass and you notice that they're moving. But you can also make just a little switch in your perception, and you can choose to see the wave of the wind. Perhaps some of you have seen that in the grasses, and you can see the wave passing through the woods and then passing through the grasses. And it's one wave that makes no distinction. It affects both, but you're no longer looking at trees or at grass, you're looking at the wind. Does that make sense? And the wind is what makes these things dance. And so we do the same thing. When we can choose, for example, to look at me and you, or we can look at flow, which flows through us, or we can look at inside and outside experience, subjective experience and objective experience, and the flow passes those boundaries. And we discover that there is not really any distinction fundamentally between me and you, or between subjective and objective, or between me and the tree. Right? So when we're doing distinguishing practice, noting practice, and I'm noting see, hear, feel, I'm looking at the trees and at the field. But when I'm doing a flow practice and I'm focusing on the motion, then I'm looking at the wind going across both. So it's not a thing. Flow is not a thing any more than we are a thing. Flow is an aspect, a characteristic that we can learn to see in the experience that we have of each moment. Now, if there is no fundamental difference between me and you, or between inside and outside, then this really has some serious implications when it comes to how we treat each other or how we interact with the world. So this concept of if I hurt you, I'm hurting me, it's not just philosophical. There's something real in it, which even as I'm saying it, sounds to me like I'm just being philosophical. Oh, it's hard to put into words unless you've experienced it. But the fact is, when you have this insight of impermanence, when you really experience that flow and that breaking down of boundaries and distinctions, it changes the way you see people and things, and inevitably changes the way you relate to people and to the world. So, we started last week with some practices of just feeling an itch increasing or decreasing, or a pain starting as a twinge and turning into a throb, or the sound of a car approaching and getting louder and passing and getting quieter. And we note these things as flow, and they seem very mundane and trivial. But when you're noticing the sound of the car, that's like noticing the tree. When you notice the change of the sound of the car, that's noticing the wind. So even in that itch and that little twinge that turns into a pain, or that becoming chilly, whatever it is, that is where the source is. That is where you touch the spirit or chi, or whatever your word for it is. The difference between something being mundane and something being transcendent is just a matter of intense concentration and clarity and equanimity. So last week I mentioned the Zen story about when you're enlightened, you'll be able to see the stone Buddha dance. And maybe that makes a little more sense now. Maybe it doesn't. If none of this makes any sense, don't worry about it. One day it will. And you don't want to get hung up on words and concepts. But let it be an encouragement that everything is dancing. The wind of the source, the constant change, the impermanence that you could look at as a cause of suffering is also the source of existence. And we can learn to see that just by looking at itches. We can dissolve into reality. And along with that, we dissolve our assumptions about what reality is. Now, you still need to live in the mundane world of eating and sleeping and hanging out with your friends. It's not as if one world passes away and you move into some weird world of no objectivity. You're constantly bouncing back and forth between the two, or being in both at the same time. But once you've had that insight, once you've seen the stone Buddha dance, you now have two worlds that you can live in. You're not limited or bound or imprisoned just by the objective, fixated, congealed world. You can go back and forth between both. So let's look at some itches and some pains. And recognize that we may not see it right now, but what we're looking at is the manifestation of the source blowing into life whatever that itch is, or that thought of the moment that is immediately gone again and arises as the next stage of that itch or thought. that's probably enough talking. And if we do it, it'll be more useful to you.